Okay, well, all right. Everybody pretty much knows what I'm going to say next, which, of course, is turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins. We're about two-thirds of the way through the book of Devarim, the final book in the Torah, a.k.a. Deuteronomy in the English. And it's at Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 18, where we begin. And this is one of those Hebrew words that, of course, is the first word in the verse, and it's going to end up being the name of the portion for that reason, or the parsha. And it's also one of those words that we see often enough in Scripture. This is probably a good one. By now, people are probably starting to remember it. Okay, the singular is shofet. And the plural is the one that's used here, shoftim. So the portion is called shoftim, and it says, shoftim ve sotrim. Now that word is not as common, but in English it's judges and officers. You shall make for yourself in all your gates, which Yahuwah your El is giving you, tribe by tribe. And they shall, there's this same root word in here having to do with to judge, shofet. They shall judge, shaftu, the people with righteous judgment. Interesting concept. Hey, wouldn't that be cool if we still had that? Honest judges, or just a righteous judgment, period. Anything associated with the rule of law, the Torah, the Scripture. Wow, cool. Thou shalt not wrest judgment, says verse 19, nor be a respecter of persons, nor shall you take a, gift is one way to translate it. Sometimes it's a bribe, but I think, as Rashi points out, this is bigger than just a bribe. This is any kind of a gift, because the gift, it says, blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. So basically, the implication here, and this is kind of a fascinating one, is even when people are in a position of being a judge, and they're supposed to impartially render judgment in accord with the Torah, the very act of taking a gift, even if it's not ostensibly as a bribe, tends to, what, blind the eyes of the wise and pervert the words of the righteous. So it's a stark reminder. And, of course, when you look and see what we have instead today, where there is no justice, especially if people are above the law, it's a whole different deal. And then the next verse is where all of this is headed, and it's one of those verses that, honestly, I read it, and you've heard me say this before, it does kind of tend to irritate me. Zedek, Zedek, justice, justice, you shall pursue, so that you might live and inherit the land which Yahuwah your El is giving to you. Now, two questions here, actually two repeated words. Justice, justice. Notice that the word here has the same root word as a person who is a righteous person, and it has the implication of being a Torah student. And, of course, righteous judgment is in accord with Torah. So that word zadik or justice, in this case, difference is just where the vowel pointers are. But it's what we are to pursue. And it's repeated twice. So why, right? Well, there are all kinds of implications. I won't say that there is a single understanding. One of the beautiful things about Torah is if there's more than one way to read it, they're probably all correct. Okay, one easy way to read it is the word is doubled because we're really, really, did you get that, really, really supposed to pay attention, especially when it comes to justice. The other one is that maybe there are multiple implications in the sentence, in the same word, like the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. It's not enough, in other words, just to simply do by rote what it says. Sometimes we have to use the brain that our Creator gave us, and sometimes that means that we have to try to interpret the bigger instruction. That's why Torah is bigger than just law. It is, in fact, instruction. So that makes sense to me as well. It's not just the letter of the law that matters, but it's the spirit of the law. Certainly there's no shortage of examples of people who don't pursue justice in, for example, our modern society, that could care less about either the letter or the spirit of the law. Interestingly, that is followed up with this. You're not to plant an Asherah tree, the kind of a tree that they would worship in a grove, nice pointy trees, spires, and so forth, of any kind, beside the altar of Yahuwah your El, which you shall make. Nor shall you set up a pillar, which Yahuwah your El hates. I guess there's an exception if we're talking Vatican City or the Roman pagan church, right? Because they set up lots of pillars. Well, no, maybe the Creator was onto something there when he made that prohibition, and when he even said he hates those things. You shall not, says the chapter next, chapter 17, shall not sacrifice unto Yahuwah an ox or a sheep or any kind of thing like that, basically, upon where there is a blemish, even any evil thing, because that is an abomination to Yahuwah, your El. Interestingly, in my notes, I have the reminder here that when it talks about a blemish or any evil thing, there is a broader implication there as well. This is including a moral blemish. Now, what does that mean with respect to an animal? Well, let your mind explore the topic. But again, the question is, what is the spirit of the law? If there is a if there's an animal or something that is going to be sacrificed that is for some reason not what it ought to be, it's not acceptable. If there's found within the midst of you, within your gates, which Yahuwah your El is going to give you, a man or a woman that does that which is evil in the sight of Yahuwah your El, by transgressing his covenant, and they have gone and served other gods and worshipped them, or the sun or the moon or any of the hosts of heaven which I have commanded you not to do, and you find out about it, it's told to you, and you hear it, well then what? Well, A, no, they don't get to run for president as a socialist. Because that's essentially what we're talking about. I've seen that in the last couple of days. Quite frankly, folks, look at what's going on in the world. We have an entire host of people that want to be the next dictator that are all basically saying, the hell with the God of the Bible. We worship everything except him. But what this next few verses is going to say is kind of fascinating in that context. That's why I mentioned that. It says, if this is told to you and you hear about it, well, then what are you supposed to do? Inquire diligently. Well, just ask them outright. Do you hate the God of the Bible? Hell yes, I do. I worship anything else but. You had the Socialist Party last week essentially saying, we are for faithless people. They've amended their party inclusiveness and said, well, we're especially Christians, Jews, Torah-observant folks. Now, you can get out of here. But anybody that's a faithless type, yeah, that's what we want. So, inquire diligently. Behold, if it turns out to be true, the thing is made certain, and such abomination is wrought in Israel. Ah, well, there you go. See, this is why we were kicked out, I guess. Then that man or woman is to be brought forth, that's done this evil thing, under your gates. That same man or woman, you shall stone them with stones, so that they die. Now, you don't do this without two or three witnesses. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses, is he that is to die shall be put to death. Not at the mouth of one witness. So we have to have redundant witnesses. And it's gonna tell us this a number of places in the Torah. And furthermore, it's a requirement that there be multiple witnesses. The hand of one witness, of the witnesses in this case, shall be the first upon him to put him to death. Afterward, the hand of all the people. This, it says, is how you shall put away the evil from the midst of you. Now, here's one of those places, again, I step back. Sometimes I simply cannot read through the Torah portion without saying, wow, how far we have come. This whole thing starts out with this idea of righteous judges. Justice, justice, you shall pursue. What is that? Well, the essence of the Tzaddik is Torah obedience. Keep away from this paganism. But you've instead got all of these people who, if we have multiple witnesses that say, well, what they say now publicly, and they're proud of it, on TV and the debates and so forth, that they hate everything associated with the God of the Bible and his word and so forth. You've got one gay scumbag essentially coming up and saying, well, my Creator loves what I do, even though his word, and he doesn't put it this way, says that it's an abomination. Now, what does Scripture say? Well, unfortunately, we're not in the land. We were kicked out for cause. And now I think the reason is clear, because we're living in a place that kind of makes good old Canaan and the Jebusites and the Perizzites and the Hittites and all look really righteous by comparison to the most of the crop of candidates that want to be the next dictator. Again, takes two witnesses, though. But this is how we failed, got kicked out. Thus, you are to put away the evil from the midst of you, as opposed to allowing the evil to rule over you. If there arises a matter that's too hard for you in judgment, between blood and blood, plea and plea, stroke and stroke, or matters of controversy within your gates, well, then you're to arise, get up to the place which Yahuwah your El shall choose, and you'll come to in that day to the priests, the Kohanim, the Levites, and the judge that will be in those days, and inquire. And they will declare to you the sentence of the judgment. And you're supposed to do according to the tenor of what they say, which they shall declare to you from the place where Yahuwah will choose. And you shall observe to do according to what it is that they teach you, according to the Torah. Now, most of the English puts the word law in there, but remember, Torah is bigger than law. This is the instruction which they shall teach you. You don't just study the law, you study the bigger picture, the instruction as a whole. According to the judgment which they shall tell you, then too, you shall do. Don't turn aside from that sentence which they declare, neither to the right nor to the left. Now, the man that does presumptuously in not hearkening unto the priest that stands to minister to you before Yahuwah your El, or to judge, that man shall die. That, again, is how you exterminate the evil from Israel. All the people, it says, shall hear and fear and do no more presumptuously. It all begins to kind of have a consistent flavor, too, doesn't it? We look back with the hindsight of history and say, well, this is exactly what didn't happen. This is how there was a falling away. This is how evil was not put out of Israel. And so as a result, what happened? The evil was literally put out of Israel by the Creator. He put Israel out, kicked them out, shellacked them, sent them away. And here we still are, still scattered throughout every nation, tribe, tongue, and place on the planet. Well, though, at least back at this point, when you come into the land which Yahuwah is giving you, and you possess it, you dwell there, and then you say something, ultimately it turns out to have been kind of stupid. 1 Samuel 8 points this out. Oh, give me a king! I'll set a king over me, like all the nations which are round about me. Remember the story in 1 Samuel 8. The first one they asked for was Samuel. He was a good-looking, tall dude, but not exactly what they should have gotten had they waited and trusted in him. Anyway, you shall not in any wise set a king, you shall set the king over you whom Yahuwah your El shall choose. He is to have some of the following qualifications. And the irony of this, I'll just kind of let sit and stink for a second as I read through it. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. What? Not gay Muslim Kenyans? Or the likes, people that essentially are, could care less about the rule of law, the God of the Bible. You could read that into this. You're not to put a foreigner over you, it says it outright, who is not your brother. And there are some requirements for the king. These are kind of interesting. There's basically three here about the thing that kings aren't to get haughty and do. And they take this form. The king is not to, A, number one, multiply horses to himself. Okay, a few horses, you can ride a few horses, but not to multiply them. In other words, not lots and lots and lots of horses to cause or not to cause the people to return to Egypt. So that for that end, he could multiply horses. For as much as Yahuwah said, nope, you're not going to go back that way again. All right, so there's A. B, the king shall not multiply wives to himself so that his heart does not turn away. Now, can the king have more than one wife? Of course. There's no prohibition in Scripture against it. There are requirements that are set forward. If a man has more than one wife, he's to do this and this and this. Of course, the whore church later on said, nope, that is verboten. We have decided to change what God wrote. And I guess if we can say that he can't have more than one wife, then we can change the rules and say, oh, but meanwhile, what the Creator says is an abomination, like lying with a man as with a woman, we'll say that's okay. We'll license that. And if that's your only claim to fame, hell, you can run for president, too, and claim that you're a better Christian than all the other people who can't read the Bible and make up their own rules along the way, or at least buy into the ones that have been made up by other men who know better than what God wrote what he should have said. Again, it's hard to read through this without having a little bit of cynicism creep in, because it becomes really clear how far we have fallen away from justice, justice you shall pursue, and the instruction that I'm writing down for you in genuine print, you shall follow and obey. Now, we're getting to the point where kings are doing certain things, and it's really, really educational to study through and see how we got here. Okay, so the king's not to multiply wives. so that his heart does not turn away. Well, we remember what happened. King David had somewhere between 13 and 17 wives. He was called a man after Yah's own heart. Didn't turn his heart away from the Creator. His son Shlomo, not so much. Solomon had lots and lots and lots. He multiplied them, for crying out loud. He had 300 wives, 700 concubines, says Scripture, and it made it really clear. They did turn his heart away. He built them not only stuff that's prohibited in here, but other places. He built shrines, Asherah poles, groves, you name it, for all kinds of foreign gods, for his foreign wives. And it did, in fact, do exactly what this said, turned his heart away. Oh, and then there's this, too. Nor shall the king greatly multiply to himself silver and gold. Arguably, Solomon kind of excelled at multiplying silver and gold, too. But the king, again, is not prohibited from having wealth. He's not even prohibited from having lots of wealth. Did you notice that? This is the only one of this set of three commandments. Don't multiply horses or wives, nor, well, silver and gold. But it doesn't say don't multiply it. It says don't multiply itself meod, a whole real lot. So he can multiply, he just not to multiply a whole lot, greatly multiply. And then there's this. Now this is the one I think we're working up to that really helps put all this in perspective. When the king sits upon the throne of his kingdom, here is what he is to do. He shall write out for himself a copy of HaTorah, this Torah, in fact, this instruction, in a sefer, a book or a scroll, out of that which is before the priests, the Kohanim, the Levites. So the king is literally to do... Now imagine, think about this for a second. The Torah, even the book of Deuteronomy, is a fairly long book. So this might take him a day or two to write this out in longhand, copy his own copy of the instruction. And by the way, there's some discussion. Usually this is understood to be just Moshe's summary here, the speech in Devarim. Although it could have been all five books. I do tend to think that would be a lot to carry around too and to write out. Certainly though, we know that throughout history there have been lots of people that have memorized it, including folks like Shaul. But he is to write out a copy of this instruction in a book. And it's to be with him. And he is to read therein all of the days of his life. So that he may learn what? To fear Yahuwah, to keep all the words of this Torah and these statutes, and to do them. This is a fundamental principle that seems to have been lost, not just in, for example, English history, most of the history of the kings of Europe, certainly the kings of Israel later, and Judah after that, after the split of the kingdoms, and indeed in so many other places throughout the pagan world and the really kind of sordid history that followed. The king gets a little bit, let's just say, uppity. Tends to think he has a divine right to rule. He is above the rest of the people, and somehow just superior. Matter of fact, that attitude seems to pervade the swamp, too. What does verse 20 say? So that his heart is not lifted up above his brethren, so that he does not turn aside from the commandment, not to the right nor to the left, to the end that he can prolong his days in the kingdom, he and his children in the midst of Israel. The king is subject to the Torah. He serves the Creator. That is his duty. He is the one who is to understand, to the point where he writes it out in his own hand, that he is bound by the covenant, as the king, to the instruction of the Torah. What a concept. All right, chapter 18, the priests, the Levites, so the Kohanim, in other words, even all of the tribe of Levi. So this is not just the Kohanim, the sons of Aaron, but all of the Levites shall have no portion nor inheritance with Israel. Now, we've heard this before. They shall eat the offerings of Yahuwah made by fire and his inheritance. They don't have inheritance, though, among their brethren. Yahuwah is their inheritance, as he has spoken. And this is to be the due of the priests from the people, from them that offer a sacrifice, whether it's ox or sheep. They give to the priest the shoulder, the two cheeks, the maw, the first fruits of all kinds of good stuff, the grains. The version I'm looking at says the corn. And we've had this discussion. Corn probably includes other, fruit of the grain. In other words, seeds, wheat, and oats, and similar kinds of things. Of the wine, and of your oil, and of the first fleece from your sheep. All of that. is to be given to him. For Yahuwah Yireh has chosen him out of all your tribes to stand and to minister in the name of Yahuwah, him and his sons, Ha'olam, forever. Now, if a Levite comes from any of your gates out of all of Israel, where he's been sojourning, and he comes with all the desire of his soul unto the place which Yahuwah shall choose, then he shall minister in the name of Yahuwah his El, his God, as all of his brethren, the Levites, do who stand there before Yahuwah. They too have no, they have like portions to eat, which is their due, according to their father's houses. So basically, this is just saying, remember, the Levites didn't get a possession in the form of land. They have a possession in the form of both a service and a blessing from the Creator. When you've come into the land which Yahuwah is giving you, do not learn. How many times have we seen this? We've just talked about it last week. Do not learn to do after the abominations of those nations. In other words, the ones that are being dispossessed and kicked out for the stuff that they were doing, the way they served their gods. Don't learn the ways of those folks. There shall be not found among you anyone that makes his son or daughter to pass through the fire, or anyone that practices divination, or is a soothsayer, or an enchanter, or a sorcerer, or all kinds of other words we've heard in the English, a witch, a warlock, a charmer, one that consults a ghost, familiar spirit, necromancer, all of those things. Anyone that does any of those things is an abomination unto Yahuwah. And because of these abominations, that is why Yahuwah Yireh is driving them out from before you. You shall be wholehearted with Yahuwah Yireh. These nations, the ones you're dispossessing, they did the things that I'm telling you not to do. They hearkened unto soothsayers, diviners, but as for you, Yahuwah Yireh has not suffered you to do so. A prophet, now this one is really interesting and key. Highlight this one in your scriptures if you have any doubts. And this is also the subject of much discussion, right? For those that that either accept or don't accept, has the Mashiach, the promised one, the prophet like unto Moshe, has he come yet? Well, there are certain things that are listed in the Torah that describe some of the characteristics, some of the requirements. Here's one of them, probably the most famous of them. And interestingly, I'll say this before I read the verse. This, by the way, is chapter 18, verse 15 of Deuteronomy. This is the only place in the Torah where Moshe himself essentially self-identifies as a prophet. Kind of interesting. Now, Moshe obviously talks to the Creator, so if there's a better definition, I'm not sure what it is. But this is one of the, it's the only place where Moshe uses this kind of language to self-describe. So here we go. A prophet, and that word here is Navi. A Navi will Yahuwah your El raise up unto you from the midst of you out of your brethren, like unto me. So this is Moshe speaking, so it is a prophet like unto what? Me, first person, unto Moshe in the third person. And unto him you shall hearken. Hearken, that word, right? We know the root there, one of the most famous of the Hebrew verbs, shamar. Tishmaun. I probably butchered the vowel pointers just a little bit in that. But you will hearken, that's y'all plural, will hearken unto him. Hear and obey. According to all that you did desire of Yahuwah in Horeb. Now here's where he's reminding them that, look, you asked for this, this is what you're going to get. This prophet like unto me. You asked for it that day in Horeb, in the midst of the assembly, saying, don't ever let me hear that again, the voice of Yahuwah my El. Don't let me see this great fire anymore, because it scared the living you-know-what out of me. I don't want to die. And that was precisely what they said. Moses is reminding them, you've asked for him to send a prophet like unto me, and that's what will happen. Yahuwah said unto me, they have well spoken. That they've asked for, that's an important and a good thing. So what am I going to do? I will raise up for them a prophet from among their brethren, like unto you, meaning like unto Moshe. I'll put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak unto them all that I shall command him. So we're talking about a prophet who will be from among the brethren, who will do what? He will be, if you will, a spokesperson for the Torah. And it'll come to pass that whoever shall not hearken unto my words, which he shall speak in my name, that I will require of him. But the prophet that instead does something otherwise, that speaks a word presumptuously in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or that shall speak in the name of other gods, that same prophet shall die. And we talked about this last week in Deuteronomy 13, following after other gods. And it's always interesting to me, and of course, as you know, I will, whenever I think about this, I think it's key. You go to Yeshua's first public address, Matthew 5, and in particular, I'm talking about verses 17 through 19. And I guess, I ought to take a minute here. I hadn't set this up, but I can find it quickly. And read those, because this is important. Because there was even a discussion online earlier. There always tends to be something like this. The question of, hey, is there a difference between Jesus and Yeshua? No, not just the vowel pointers and the name and that kind of thing. But if Jesus, as we've been told by the liars who call him a liar, if he did away with the law, nailed it to the cross, well then, what? We've just read it for the second time in as many portions. If he speaks that which I have not commanded him to speak, or speaks in the name of other gods, in other words, if he does away with my Torah, that prophet shall die. What is the very first public thing that Yeshua says, the so-called Sermon on the Mount? Matthew 5:17. Again, do not think, he says, that I came to destroy the Torah or the Navi'im. Now, the reference there, Torah and the prophets, if you've heard the acronym Tanakh, that's Torah, Ketuvim, Navi'im, Torah, writings, and prophets. And that's what Yeshua is talking about. In other words, the words of the prophets, the words of the instruction. Didn't come to change, no, not any of it. I didn't come to destroy it, but instead to fulfill it. Well, here's one of the elements of that. The prophet like unto Moshe is one of the things, arguably, that he's talking about fulfilling. But all the other things that the Torah is talking about too. For assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away. A quick pause. Anybody checked lately? Last I looked, yep, I'm looking out the window. They're still there. So, what he is fixing to say is still true. Till heaven and earth pass away, not one jot nor tittle, not one yod or tittle, will by any means pass from the Torah till all is fulfilled. Kol, all. And if, A, heaven and earth still exist, B, he hadn't come back, see, there are a whole bunch of other prophetic things. I can think of Damascus, that's still a city. A lot of other stuff hasn't happened yet. So clearly, not one jot nor tittle, not one yod or tittle of Torah has been done away with. Anybody that tells you different, calls him a liar, is A, lying to you, and B, committing blasphemy is probably an understatement. Because we're told, right? Some prophet speaks a word presumptuously, saying it's in my name that I haven't commanded him to speak. That prophet shall die. All right, so that pretty well clarifies, I think, any distinction that we need to make between a fake prophet and, again, we had it last week. We're getting a quick repeat here. Speaks in the name of other gods, or speaks that which I have not commanded him to speak, or basically says the law is done away with when the Torah says clearly it's not, and those who speak in accord with it, including the Torah made flesh, confirm that. Well, then it says this. Well, wait a minute. If you say in your heart, how shall we know the word which Yahuwah hasn't spoken? Answer. Now, this is kind of tough because at the time this was written, there were still a whole bunch of prophets, a lot of prophets that hadn't come yet, most of the most famous prophets in Scripture, from essentially Elijah through all of those that get books named after them. None of them had come yet. So how do we know? Well, when a prophet speaks in the name of Yahuwah, if a thing doesn't happen, if it doesn't come to pass, that thing is something which Yahuwah has not spoken. Now, we also saw last week there are some other requirements, too, if he speaks in the name of fake gods and so forth. So this is a necessary but not sufficient condition, is how the mathematician would put it. Well, anyway, if he says something that doesn't happen, that prophet has spoken presumptuously. Don't fear him. And ponder this, though. We have some folks that we pretty well acknowledge because of the numbers of things that they have spoken. I'm thinking Isaiah, Yeshayahu, in other words, Yermayahu, you name it. All those guys got books named after them. Eliyahu and others that speak in certain of the books and don't have, their names are in the Scriptures, but they don't have a book of their own, for example, at least in what we would call the modern Bible. But still, we recognize that there are some things and some of those prophecies haven't yet happened. Okay. That's why I call this a necessary but not sufficient condition. We just haven't seen it yet. Chapter 19, when Yahuwah your El cuts off those nations, the ones that he is giving you, and they're going to be kicked out of the land, and when you succeed them and dwell in their cities and their houses, well, here's what you're going to do. And this basically are what's called the cities of refuge. This too gets mentioned several times, and what I'm going to do is summarize some of the next few verses. Three cities in the midst of your land, which Yahuwah gives you. Prepare the way, divide the borders of the land, and into three parts. The idea is this is a place for the manslayer to flee. Now, we're going to get some specifics about how a manslayer is not the same as a murderer. How can we tell? This is the case for the manslayer, so that he can flee to this set-aside place and live. The one who kills his neighbor unawares, in other words, by accident. Oops, it was a tragic occurrence. We're going to get some examples. But he had not hated him in times past. In other words, this is not a guy who we clearly knew had a grudge and may have been secretly seeking to pull an Arkanside or something. As when a man goes into the forest, so here's one of our examples, with his neighbor, going to cut down some wood. And he begins to stroke back with his axe to cut down a tree, and oops, the head comes off. And it hits his neighbor in the head and causes him to die. Well, he better get out of Dodge. He flees to one of these cities, and he can live, lest, you killed my brother, you dirty rat, lest his avenger of blood, a brother or a uncle or a cousin or whatever it is, come after him, while his heart is hot, and overtake him and smite him mortally. So interestingly, now Scripture doesn't say what happens to that guy. And presumably, it's the way this is worded, and yeah, there's been a lot of discussion in the Midrash, of course, but the point is, it sounds like this is something that is very not only possible, but even likely to happen, which is why these cities are being set aside. Okay, so the guy, though, wasn't deserving of death, but somebody that was really hot because he just killed his brother or whatever comes and kills him. And he had not hated the man in the past. So, that's why I'm commanding you, says Yahuwah. You shall separate these three cities. Now, if he enlarges your border, as he has sworn to your fathers, and gives you all the land that he has promised to give you, and if you shall keep this commandment and do it, which I command you to this day, to love Yahuwah, to walk ever in his ways, then you can add more cities, three more cities for you besides the first three. And innocent blood shall not be shed in the midst of the land. I always think that's an interesting verse, isn't it? Innocent blood shall not be shed in the midst of the land. Well, obviously they're not talking about America with a K, where innocent blood can get you baby parts for sale and be a billion-dollar industry. Or where, well, let's just put it this way, innocent blood is shed as a routine part of justice we're not going to be allowed to pursue anymore. What does it say? Innocent blood is not shed in the midst of the land that Yahuwah is giving you for an inheritance, because what? So that blood would not be upon you. Wow. Now, on the other hand, we're going to talk about the alternative case, a guy who is not a manslayer but a murderer. If a man hates his neighbor, lies in wait for him, rises up against him, smites him mortally that he dies, then he flees to one of those cities, he's not welcome. What? Aren't all immigrants supposed to be welcome anywhere? How does this city... Okay, well, then the elders of the city shall send and fetch this dude and deliver him into the hand of the avenger of blood so that he may die. This immigrant is not going to be well welcomed. He's a murderer. Okay, I'm tempted to say something else, but your mind is probably going the same direction mine is. Again, how far have we come from justice? Your eye shall not pity him, but you shall put away the blood of the innocent from Israel, that it may go well with you. Wow. Now, there's some other things here, too. Don't remove your neighbor's landmark, which has been set for a while of time old, in that inheritance which you shall inherit, in the land which Yahuwah is giving you to possess. So you don't move a boundary marker and say, oh, look, my land just got a little bit bigger. Aren't I clever? One witness, we've talked about this in this same portion. One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin that he sins. Well, I guess unless there's a red flag law. In that case, you don't even have to have a witness. We just say, I think he might have a weapon. Go get him. Okay, no, justice. This says going to have two witnesses or three witnesses in order to establish a matter. Now, this I've always found interesting because here is another place where, wouldn't it be cool if we had justice and law? If an unrighteous witness rises up against any man to bear perverted witness against him. Let's just say, for example, a special prosecutor is appointed to accuse somebody who was elected instead of the person who wasn't elected of a crime that the other person committed. You kind of catch where I'm headed with this? Or any number of other things. In other words, we have an entire Department of Justice whose job seems to be to what? Pervert justice, accuse the innocent people, and let the guilty off. What does Torah say when an unrighteous witness rises up against someone to bear perverted witness against him? Well, A, this is why we have shoftim, judges. Both men, between whom this controversy is, shall stand before Yahuwah. I guess if that won't work, we can have somebody, you know, wearing black robes and pretending to serve another god. Again, folks, it's hard not to be sarcastic when you see how far we have come from this. I look at this and I think, no wonder we have come so far down the you-know-what chute. Because, well, we've been told for 17-plus centuries, the law is done away with. And you look at America, and it's hard to argue. It sure as hell has been. We've been building a hell on earth now and working hard at it for decades, but it's finally coming to real satanic fruition. But back when we had the rule of law, they would stand before Yahuwah, and before the Kohanim, and the Shoftim, the priests and the judges, that will be in that time. Okay? And the judges shall inquire diligently. And behold, if the witness is shown to be a false witness, and he is in fact testified falsely against his brother, well then what? This is beautifully, wonderfully just. You do to that unrighteous witness precisely what he had been trying to do, what he had purposed to do to his brother. Tried to convict him of murder? Tried to convict him of theft, tried to convict him of treason, of being a Russian, whatever. Isn't it interesting, too, and this is just an aside, oftentimes, this is, by the way, right out of Hitler's Mein Kampf, you know you're guilty of a crime, what do? You convict somebody else for it. You accuse your enemy of doing that which you know darn well you did. Well, here's Torah saying we knew that was going to happen all along. So he is guilty, in fact, of what he is trying to unrighteously convict his brother, claiming he did when he didn't. You shall do unto him as he purposed to do to his brother. This is how you put away the evil from among you. Like I said, what happens today? The evil rises to the top of the Federal Bureau of Instigation, covers for the crimes of others. Jeffrey Epstein, who knows what happened to him, but Arkansas is probably the easiest way to describe it. Here is a guy that had the goods on all kinds of people. Folks, we have an entire world where everybody knows justice is the last thing you're going to see from the Department of Just Us. And unrighteous witnesses are far more likely to be allowed to run for president than ever to wear an orange jumpsuit. And by the way, even prison isn't a Torah-compliant penalty. Most of the things that we're talking about here that people that are now getting away with it, had there been honest judges, the penalty would be death. Okay, those that remain shall hear and fear, and henceforth commit no more such evil in the midst of you. What do we have instead? Well, like I just said, those kinds of evil people tend to grab others of their ilk, put them in positions of power. Why? Because they have the goods on them. They know they can embarrass them publicly, convict them. The mafia principle is called omerta. And I could give you example after example of really criminal people installed in places like the Attorney General's office that everybody knew was crooked to the core. Matter of fact, some Attorney Generals, like the one in there now, even managed to come back after having gotten other criminals off. What happens? Well, this is what the Torah says. Those that remain, those that can see what justice looks like, and what justice perverted results in, they shall hear and fear, and henceforth commit no more such evil in the midst of you. What do we have instead? We have people who hear and who fear what? Those who get away with this kind of crime can shut them up, can kill them, can have them arc-incited, can make their lives miserable, can take their stuffs, and now can red flag them, call out and SWAT them, and so forth. And what's the result? Those who hear and fear are those who, well, ideally, would have once upon a time at least been Torah obedient. Now, what are we supposed to do? Fear those who can not kill the body, but kill the soul. No wonder we have evil running rampant and literally having taken over. We're not in the land, and we don't deserve to be. Your eye shall not pity. Life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Now, the general principle here, getting again back to this idea of the spirit of the law rather than simply the letter of the law, is if somebody puts out your eye, and we see this other places, for example, putting out their eye doesn't serve anybody. Okay, it may be a lesson to other people, but especially in the case of an accident or some crime of anger or whatever, being a bondservant and being literally indebted to the person that was wronged, in other words, to make right that which is wrong, is a far better answer. I would contend that what the general principle here is, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, is measure for measure. And I've usually expressed it this way. If somebody commits a heinous act of negligence, gross negligence, and it costs, let's say, the neighbor his hand, or his eye, or his tooth, and you ask the fellow who committed the wrong, okay, what is your eye, your hand, your tooth worth to you? What would you pay not to have your hand, your tooth, your eye removed? Oh, I'd give quite a bit of money for that. Well, then that is what you owe your brother. Measure for measure. You make restitution. Your eye's worth, what, $100,000 to you? Pay up. And if you can't pay up, you serve him as a bondservant for up to 7 years. But understand, the concept is measure for measure. Make right that which is wrong. All right, chapter 20 is going to refer again to that first word that we used, shoterim. We'll see it through here. When you go forth to battle against your enemies, and you see horses and chariots and a people that are really scary, there's more of them than you, do not be afraid of them. For Yahuwah, your El, is with you. He's the one, remember, brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And it'll be that when you draw nigh into the battle, the Kohen shall approach, and he'll speak to the people. And he shall say to them the following, right? Shema, O Israel. Today you draw nigh unto battle against your enemies. Do not let your heart be faint. Fear not. Kazakh. Nor be alarmed, don't be affrighted at them, because Yahuwah your El, he is the one that goes forth before you, with you, to fight for you against your enemies to save you. Now, at this point, the shoterim, the officers, will speak to the people, and they say the following. We got basically a list here. We're going to see that there are some folks who are going to be given a, what would we call it, a deferment from the battle. Somebody built a new house, hasn't dedicated it. Well, let him go return to his house, lest he die in the battle, and another man be the one to dedicate that house. How about a man that's just planted a new vineyard, hasn't used the fruit thereof? Hey, I can raise my hand. Got a vineyard out there, and no fruit yet. Let him go return to his house, lest he die in the battle, and another man use the fruit thereof. How about a man that has betrothed a wife, but he hasn't yet lachak her. He has not yet consummated the marriage. Let him go and return unto his house, lest he die in battle, and another man take her. And then it says the shoterim shall speak further to the people, and they say, all right, let's see here. The B list at this point. Got anybody that's fearful and faint-hearted? Got some wussies out there amongst us? Let him go and return to his house, lest his brethren's heart melt like his does. And it shall be that when the officers have made an end of speaking to the people, and the captain of hosts shall be appointed as the heads of the people. So, we got the speaking out of the way, got the people who are headed back home, headed in that direction, and now we're going to have captains appointed to head the people. When you draw nigh to a city to fight against it, what? First proclaim peace. Shalom unto the city. And it shall be, now remember, this is a place where the people have been commanded, go take the land. The Creator is going to go before you, but the commandment is to take the land. And as a general rule, of those folks that we're going to see here later, there's going to be a whole lot of killing going on. But it is to be that if there is an answer of peace and they open their gates to you, well, all of the people that are found therein shall become tributary. They will be bondservants unto you, and they will serve you. And on the other hand, if they will not make peace with you, but instead to go to war, then you besiege the city. And then when Yahuwah delivers it into your hand, notice it doesn't say if, it says when, he delivers it into your hand, you smite every male thereof with lefi cherem, the mouth of the sword. Edge of the sword is the King James wording, but really lefi, the mouth of the sword. What does the sword do? It eats blood. The mouth of the sword. And when Yahuwah your El delivers it into your hand, smite every male with the mouth of the sword. But the women and the little children and the cattle, everything else in the city, the spoil, you shall take for a prey. You literally have war brides, captives, and so forth. We'll talk about some of that, by the way, in the next Torah portion. It's politically incorrect, but as we've been seeing, so is justice justice. So as hard as some of the things that Scripture talks about may be to our modern post-biblical and, hell-bent ears, I think it's important that we go back and recognize that you want to see why it is that the world is such a mess? Look no further than these portions and the claim that the law is done away with, and yep, this is the bitter fruit that we reap. So, the women, the cattle, all of the little children, all the things in the city, everything in there, the spoil, you take for a prey. A prize is one of the modern military terms you'll hear. The goods of the city. Eat the spoil of your enemies, which Yahuwah your God has given you. This is what you will do unto all of the cities which are very far off from you, which are not of the cities of these nations. Say, what? I mean, there's a difference? You betcha. However, the cities of these peoples that Yahuwah is giving you for an inheritance, you shall save alive nothing that breathes. Oh, now I've had people tell me with a straight face, oh, I can't worship a God that would say that. Okay? I'll throw out one other piece now. There's a whole lot of midrash on this. This is the kind of thing that maybe tomorrow if there's questions, it's always interesting to discuss, to talk about. But I tend to think that those who refer to the DNA of human beings and the DNA of other things, the sons of the sons of the sons of the Nephilim, the fallen angels, if you will, the host of Hashemayim that bred with women a long, long time ago, and they had kind of half-breed children, genetically poisoned DNA. Remember what we're told about Moshe. His bloodline was pure before Yahuwah. He was perfect in his generations, is how it's usually translated. But that's certainly one way to read it. So basically, one way to understand this is we're going to see these cities of these peoples that are in the land of Canaan that are being given to the sons of Israel for an inheritance. You are to save nothing alive. He wants that bloodline exterminated. Period. You shall utterly destroy these. The Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, as Yahuwah your El has commanded you. Now there's another problem with them, and maybe this fits, right? Because they would teach you otherwise to do after all of their abominations. In other words, they would look a lot like the swamp critters infesting the District of Criminals swamp. We know that what happened is they didn't get expunged. And exactly what happened was they did teach these abominations, which they've done to their gods. And we, as a result, got kicked out of the land and have, in fact, sinned against Yahuwah. And furthermore, the whore churches, Israel and Judah, Roman pagan church, and a whole bunch of others have adopted those ways, added and subtracted, and done all the things that he says he hates. And they've put all of those abominations right into the mainstream. And again, we are reaping the ugly, bitter, satanic fruit. Now, this last one is kind of interesting, too. And it almost seems, let's just say, ought to raise some eyebrows. When you besiege a city, got a long time, you make war against it to take it. You do not destroy the trees thereof by cutting them down with an axe. Leave the trees alone. because you can eat of them. So we're talking, in other words, about fruit trees or nut trees, it sounds like, or olive trees, the kinds of trees that bear edible stuff. For what is the tree of the field for man that it should be besieged by you? Now, only the trees that you know aren't food trees, those you can cut down and destroy, so that you can build bulwarks against the city that makes war against you until it falls. So you got trees that aren't good for food, cut them down, use them for wood, and build war machines. Chapter 21 is the first few verses here are the last part of this week's portion, and it's going to conclude with another reference to something that kind of permeates this chapter, this idea of innocent blood and not being shed in the land, and how can we do justice? So here we go. Chapter 21 says, if somebody is found slain in the land which Yahuwah has given you to possess, out there lying in the field, don't know, though, who it was that smote him, then your elders and your judges come forth, and they shall measure the distances to the nearby towns. Right? So they're going to pace it off, or maybe they get their little wheel on a stick, right? And they measure it and say, okay, it's a mile and a quarter to your town, and it's 5/8 of a mile to our town. Oops, I guess he's ours. So they find the one that's closer to the guy who has been slain. And it shall be that whichever city is nearest to the slain man, the elders of that city, now they have a responsibility. What are they going to do? They go take, and I've always thought this is both poignant and painful, but it really says something to us if we'll just hearken. They go get a heifer of the herd, which has not been wrought with, has not yet drawn in the yoke. So here's this poor young heifer, hasn't been harnessed, hasn't done much yet in its life. The elders of the city bring that heifer down into a rough valley, one which is not plowed nor sown, and they break that poor little heifer's neck right there in the valley. Why? What's the point? It really ought to resonate. The priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for those are the ones that Yahuwah has chosen to minister unto him, and to bless in the name of Yahuwah, and according to their word shall every controversy and every stroke be. So these are the people who are basically going to render what? Zadik, justice. They're going to make the decree. The elders of the city that are nearest to that man who was slain, they wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. Now, this is called the Eglah, the heifer Arufa. And I like Rashi's comment on this. This is an outrageous thing. Poor heifer has its neck broken in the valley. This is an outrage. Well, you know what? So is the killing of this man, where nobody knows what happened or why. That's an outrage too. And here's what they speak over this dead heifer. Our hands have not shed this blood. Neither have our eyes seen it. Now, the additional commentary from Rashi is kind of interesting here, too. In other words, not even indirectly. They are making a proclamation. Now, of course, we got people today in the United States put their hand on a Bible and lie. They take oaths that they don't intend. Not only that, they openly campaign that they're going to destroy God-given rights and the hell with the law that they propose that they're going to faithfully execute. What a bunch of lying criminals, all right? The elders of the city, though, wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken, and they say, our hands have not shed this blood, nor have our eyes seen it. And the implication, says Rashi, is they didn't even see it indirectly. In other words, they could have taken care of this stranger. They didn't. So they didn't even do that. Okay? We don't, I guess you could say the Sergeant Schultz thing, right? I know nothing about what is going on here. That is the proclamation that they're making. And then they add the following. Forgive, O Yahuwah, your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, and suffer not innocent blood to remain in the midst of your people Israel. And this blood shall be forgiven them. Think about the outrage. Think on, and this is where I guess it's a great way to conclude the portion. Think about the outrage of an entire society already having been kicked out of the land that essentially has said, no, we worship at the God of a whole different Bible. We got people whose only claim to fame is, well, if there's an abomination before the Creator, they teach it, they live it, and that might be the only thing that they do that qualifies them to be the next dictator. Okay? I commit an abomination of a man lying with a man. And this is the guy that the media tells us is the only good Christian. Good grief. In the whole field of socialist wannabe tyrants. What an outrage, folks. They glorify themselves for their hatred of the God of the Bible and Torah. He hasn't been allowed in the schools for a long time. Hasn't been allowed in the courts for a long time. Justice, justice, not here. And he isn't allowed in the White House. And he's not going to be allowed anywhere close to the District of Criminal Swamp. These people say, forgive, O Yahuwah, your people Israel, that you've redeemed. Don't let this innocent blood remain in the midst of your people Israel. Well, let's just put it this way. The opposite is true today. They drink. Yeah, I'll say it. They literally drink. They salivate at the concept of innocent blood. I saw a story this week. We'll talk about some of the news in a minute here. But a Swedish professor saying, you know what? We got to get to the point where we talk openly about cannibalism. This is modern world politics. Oh, can't be eating cows. Can't be eating things that are food. No, no, let's eat people instead. And you know, yeah, everybody's seen Soylent Green, Chuck Heston, right? Soylent Green is people. It was an outrageous movie. We're talking about an outrage here. All of those outrages, folks, are trivial compared to the outrage that now passes for justice in a land where justice is not only not pursued, it's not allowed. The blood of this innocent man shall be forgiven them. The last verse says the following, so shall you put away the innocent blood from the midst of you. When you do that which is right in the eyes of Yahuwah. I'll say it again. How far have we come when they lust for the innocent blood and explicitly, deliberately, with wanton forethought and pride, do that which they know damned well is an abomination in the eyes of Yahuwah? And yep, they're proud of it. It's part of the reason why I say week after week, come out of her, be separate, don't participate. And for crying out loud, look at the world and say, well, I'll say it bluntly again. I've been using this word a lot. Get the hell out of there. Because there are people, clearly, who have a singular intent. It is to create a living hell on earth. Because they serve a satanic master. And we need to be separate. Come out and be separate. Speak. Do not allow the outrage and the innocent blood to taint us. Yeah, we're still in exile. But we can separate ourselves from that, and we had better, because it's coming down and it's coming hard.